listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, County Reporter Susan Franzen, together with my co-host and County Reporter, Paul Wearson. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Susan. How are you? And we're into our Christmas season now and talking about Christmas and all kinds of things Christmassy. And we have a great show today.
Yes, we do. Today, we're headed west to Jefferson at the far edge of our listening area to visit RVP 1875, which is the very unique version of Santa's Workshop that is in that town, and we'll get a preview of the New Year's entertainment they'll be having at their theater. We talked with Robbie Peterson a couple of weeks ago, but that was just enough to make us want to make a real road trip to see for ourselves.
Yes, Robbie, he lived in Story City for a while and had his shop in Story City, and of course, Robbie does theater, as we'll find out as the program progresses, and I've been in a couple of shows with Robbie. He's a multi-talented person, as we'll find out, and he has a new venue over there in Jefferson, so this is a fun road trip.
It was really a trip. On the way home, we passed some Christmas tree farms, and we thought we'd try to mention other Christmas tree farms for those people who haven't yet gone out to get their tree. And, of course, Christmas tree farms now really make this an experience. It's not like what it was when I went out with my kids and we just found a tree and cut it down and strapped it on the top of the car. There are really some interesting things going on when you get your tree. It's really a party. So, shall we get started on our road trip?
Let's go.
On the road again. Places that I've never been, seeing things that I may never see again.
Well, for this road trip, I parked my old 1996 Buick in front of Susan Franson's house and got into their 2007 red Toyota Prius, and we headed west. And Fritz was along, Susan's husband, because he was interested in seeing all the furniture making going on at Robbie Peterson's.
Yes, and he also drove. So you got to be a passenger for a change.
Yes, I got to ride.
Robbie Peterson's RVP 1875 is a very special experience for anyone, but especially for any woodworker. As soon as we walked through the door of the shop, we entered a different world. There was Robbie, wearing a black wide-brimmed hat like an Amish farmer, a striped shirt. I didn't ask him if it was hand-woven. Probably was the kind of calico that came west with the first shipments of goods. Knee breeches, suspenders, and black boots.
And these were boots that Grant would envy. I really thought they were great. I think everything Robbie wears is period piece. But, you know, the clothes were just a small part of our RVP 1875, and let's hear Robbie's explanation.
We're in the year 1875 with everything we do. That's the year I do all of my research, and that's the year we use all the tools from, all the techniques from. But being in the year 1875 Iowa, we get to build two generations of furniture. See, some people are just getting here in that covered wagon. They're those pioneers I've been talking about. But some people have been here 40 years already, and they're ready for the 8-foot wardrobe and the 10-foot tables. Full time, they didn't need to save space, they just needed good furniture. So we call that second generation furniture.
The large workshops and showrooms were filled with a bewildering variety of furniture pieces, but he took us first to see a simple piece he called a chimney cupboard.
For 2 feet of floor, you see, story, you got 7.5 feet of storage, but only giving up 2 feet of floor. And in the average pioneer, they'd move here in their covered wagon. They built a 10 by 14 log cabin. And so big wardrobes and hutches and pie safes and all those pieces were not even an option. They took up too much floor. And so tall and skinny was the way to maximize that floor space. So this would be the only cupboard in a typical Pioneer cabin, chimney cupboard. We know that there were 10,000 of these made in Iowa alone. And yet, I've never seen one in antique form. That's what gets crazy is what happened to 10,000 chimney cupboards. And so we specialize in bringing those pieces back then and reintroducing to the world to what was a very important popular piece 100 years ago.
Why is it called a chimney?
Because they're tall and skinny like a chimney. That's how they get their name. Yeah, they have nothing to do with placing it by the chimney or anything like that. But you see, with it being tall and skinny, it's just chimney shaped.
I was curious about the kinds of wood they use for their furniture. So I asked Robbie, you looked around these incredible pieces in the shop, do you use all Iowa wood?
We do. We only use the woods that we can prove were being used in Iowa in 1875, which means 17 different species of woods. Like just around us in this room here, this is butternut, poplar, willow, pine, fir, ash, walnut, birch, bird's eye pine. There's a cherry piece over there. So there's just a few of the cottonwood. There's just a few of the ones here in this one room. But we only use the wood if we can prove it was being used in Iowa in 1875. I'm not importing mahogany. But like if we were in Philadelphia in 1875, that's what you would have been using, imported mahogany. You know, so it's a matter of not only when you are, but where you are. We always talk about 1875 Iowa is equivalent to 1820 Ohio or 1780 Pennsylvania. Furniture style-wise. It's a style that moved west with the farmer. And that's an important thing to know.
As Robbie said, that was just one room. Later he showed me a table made of catalpa and a cupboard made of black ash. I was really fascinated with those two woods. The black ash was so beautiful. It had a dark grain and a light wood. And the catalpa, I couldn't imagine using catalpa for furniture. He said it's wonderful because it's so lightweight. But since it's Christmas time, I couldn't resist asking him about Christmas gifts. These would be pretty large and expensive Christmas gifts. And he told me about a unique gift that couldn't be wrapped or put under the Christmas tree.
You know, we give gift certificates out. You know, people come and purchase gift certificates for either furniture or our classes. We give a 3-day weekend class in here. Oh, we do that 5 weekends out of the year. People come from all over the country, and we give them 4 choices of pieces of furniture to build. And over the course of those 3 days, they learn how to make dovetail joints and groove joints and plane the boards and saw the boards and chisel out the joints. And they take a piece home on Sunday, a piece of furniture home with them that they've been building all the 3 days.
Show me what you can build in 3 days.
Okay.
Well, you have to learn how to do the dovetails.
Well, when you have a good teacher, this bench with storage in it is one of the pieces. I would call that the easiest of the 4 pieces. People with no experience at all, I tend to kind of lean them towards that piece. There's a trunk here we call the apprentice's trunk. And this is probably the most time-consuming of the 4 pieces because it's got 4 corners and skirts. It's got 3 times as many dovetails as the rest of the pieces. There's a small desk and a small cupboard they can choose from as well. But those are the pieces that they can build in 3 days. And just depending on how well they're doing, how fast they are, then matters how involved I get on Sunday to make sure that they get done.
So yes. Sometimes you have to do a little last-minute help. Is that right?
Yeah, sometimes if they need a hand, you know, or a mistake has been made and they need to start over on an end, or they're wearing out, you know, physically, that kind of thing. I always tell people on Friday that you just let me know and I will get involved as you want me to get.
You know, what I found most interesting was the way he worked, how he decided what to make, and how he used what he called extinct concepts.
I've got the Ebenezer Scrooge stand-up desk here. But stand-up desks were very popular in the era, especially amongst tradesmen, people who stood for a living and worked. We all know you're working along, you sit down, you lose your momentum. And so they like to stand throughout the course of the day. This particular one, I usually don't reproduce furniture. Usually, like, if I'm going to make a hutch, I have a notebook full of the 300 period hutches I've seen over the years. You know, every time I see an old hutch, I measure it, I take notes from it, I take pictures from it, and I've got notebooks full of all that. And then I blend all that information into my prototype hutch and trust my taste, you know, after that. But this one here is a true reproduction. The first governor of Iowa, Robert Lucas, he was a lawyer and he didn't like getting up and down all day. He preferred a stand-up writing desk, which is in the Historical Society right now, and so I was able to actually get the dimensions off of the actual one, and they made that out of locust, and that's what this wood is. Locust, the tree with the big thorns, mm-hmm. Which is a very white wood. See how white that is. And so to get dark red on here, that's boiled walnuts and raspberries, and that's how I get that color. but so hard. That's a third again harder than oak, that locust. It's so hard. So it's indestructible. There's no way. We've given it no choice with the wooden joinery that we put into our pieces. We've given it no choice but to be around in hundreds of years.
Unlike the chimney cupboards.
Well, for them. See, here's the thing. You could get that chimney cupboard in 1875 Iowa for $3. $3 got you soft wood, nailed together joints. If you could afford it, you would have it made out of wooden joinery. So that means dovetail in every corner. We groove in every shelf, every back, every bottom has locking tongue and groove and mortise and tenon joints. But that took a little longer to do. So it doubled the cost of the piece. So it was $6 instead of $3. And that piece in pine that takes us 20 hours takes 40 hours in oak or walnut. The harder the wood, the longer it takes to make it. So that doubled the cost again. So the chimney cupboard's price range at the time was $3 to $12. So because we don't see them 100 years later, you can imagine what they all cost. When I'm looking at the logbooks, they're all $3, $4, or $5. They were hardly ever wooden jointed, not hardwood. They were get you by. You know, they needed something that they could afford, that got them by for 20 years. And then they'd come back in and get something better later. So we don't do nailed together versions in here. We only wooden joint. We've used the last 20 years to build up a reputation as the strongest furniture in the world. So we're not going to compromise that with nailed together versions. But we do use all the same pricing that they used in 1875. So as I'm researching a piece of furniture, a dollar in 1875 is worth about 100 right now, rate of inflation. So as I'm researching a $5 piece back then, it's 500 in our shop. It's the same amount of money. Which means I also know how many hours it's supposed to take. And so I only spend 30 hours on a 30-hour piece. If I spend 50 hours on a 30-hour piece, one, not only does the customer have to pay for 50 hours, but two, they're not getting the same piece of furniture. They're getting something a little too refined. It wouldn't have looked like an 1870s furniture piece coming out of a place like Iowa. It would have looked more like a factory piece that was a little too perfect. So there's this line on everything.
Before we left the workshop and went into the theater, Robbie showed us some extinct machines. He mentioned the chimney cupboard, which is an extinct piece that you can't find any of them, the old ones. And there were a couple others that are very rare that he has made prototypes of. But the extinct machines, which are all human-powered, were very interesting. And Paul, could you describe these?
Well, they had several of those, and it was amazing how effective they are. He had a table saw that you could pedal, and that seemed to operate with the same velocity and efficiency as a modern table saw powered by electricity. And then he had a huge lathe that he got from the original Amish community over in eastern Iowa. And that was, he used his arm to actually power that, but with his biceps, you know, up and down, a lever. And then he had a velocipede, really what you'd call a bicycle, where he could pedal this bandsaw. And he proceeded to cut some intricate designs there. And Fritz, your husband, who's a woodworker, said, I have nothing in my modern shop that can cut that precisely. So he was in awe of this machine. And throughout that place, I was so amazed by not only those wonderful machines, but also just the practicality and some of the neat little things they built into furniture then that were utterly practical. But Robbie says some of those things, it's a mystery to him why they're no longer used as a technique because they were so practical and effective. You have drawers that go all the way through tables and suspend table extensions, all kinds of things that fold into different shapes so you can really utilize the space in a small cabin. I was just amazed at how inventive and pragmatic our ancestors were.
If anybody has ever pulled a drawer all the way out and dumped the contents, they would appreciate one of the things that has become obsolete, and that is to have the back of the drawer a little higher. You have to have the bottom rounded, the corner rounded, so you can slip it in. But that way you can pull it all the way out and you don't dump the stuff out. Now, this has been totally lost. I probably was lost when they went to machine-made furniture. And, well, it just wasn't done anymore.
Yeah, there's so many things that were part of Robbie's world there in 1875 that just, probably you're right, they went out the window with machine furniture and a factory-type environment to build furniture in. boy, someone should revisit this because everyone's pulled a drawer out with all the contents falling on the floor. What a simple way to solve the problem.
Well, another thing, he mentioned that there aren't any of the chimney cupboards found anywhere. I mean, you don't find them in antique shops. I think he found one in a museum, but really they're almost non-existent. But the other thing that is really rare are these machines, because they were made out of metal. And we were trying to figure out why they wouldn't have survived. And what was your guess, Paul?
Well, I think you can see that in farms. In my farm, I'm living on a farm where Dad started farming in 1930 with horses. There are all kinds of things out there that I don't know what they're for. They're tools, you know, that used to be prevalent. But when something falls into disuse, if it's made out of metal, and a lot of it was prior to World War II, we have to remember that during World War II, there were massive scrap drives to get metal. And Robbie mentioned, too, that probably a lot of these things were simply melted down for war use in World War II in the 1940s. So I'm sure he had trouble finding some of these vintage machines. And those chimney cupboards, it just shows you how poor people were. Almost everybody probably went for the nailed-together version. And so most of them just decomposed and, you know, fell apart.
And there were handy firewood when you had something really better, like a nice pie safe.
Oh, sure. And then you have home fires and all kinds of things that happen. So I'm not surprised, but I guess I am surprised that none have been found. That's remarkable.
Yes, we talk a lot about extinct species, but we don't think very much about extinct man-made species.
That's right.
Well, the next thing that happened was that just as we were on our way to the door to go into the theater, Robbie just mentioned how the rest of the building was used, because he also has apprentices, and he also lives on site. So what did he say about that?
We've turned the 5,000 feet above us right here into our house, and it's got over, 25-foot tall vaulted ceilings and everything. We've got rooms that we have apprentices that live in here when they come and spend the 2 years with us.
And then we walked through the door marked Raccoon River Artisan Colony, and we entered the huge space left in the former brick lumber yard known as the History Boy Theater.
Well, it's quite a building here. You know, what we're talking about here is, which you can imagine as a radio listener, is a sort of a cavernous area, and you can see where lumber was once stored and where this was really where they had all their plywood and 2x4s. And there's a very, very high ceiling you can do a lot with. There's a sort of mezzanine walkway. And you said you can have patrons at that level too. And then down here we have a graduated seating up off the floor. And then an ample area on both sides of the seating. And really a very commodious forgiving stage.
Yes, and notice like the widths of the aisles there. You know, I was looking up the standards in how you're supposed to place your seating in a theater, and everybody's so tight and close together, and nobody's comfortable. And we just decided early on, you know, I'd rather have 120 really comfortable people than squashing 150 people in. That's what we do.
Where did you get your seating? It looks so velvety and inviting.
Well, these are a reproduction seat. We went all the way to Dallas, Texas for these. We heard about a theater group that lost its performance space, so we called them up and said, what are you going to do with your seats? And they said, drive on down and we'll sell them to you. And so we went down that weekend and got us 150 theater seats.
Well, they're beautiful. Very nice.
The balcony ones are about 60 years old, and they came actually from Webster City up by your neck of the woods. Sure. They decided to change out their seating here in the last couple of years. They went with the modern theater way to do it is this oversized seating. We've all gotten a little bit bigger over the course of the last 40 years or so. And what we did was we took those cool, great old metal seats with nice thick pads on them, and we invented this spacer that makes them all 6 inches wider anyway. And so they ended up just working wonderfully for us.
Now, which theater did that come from in Webster City?
The Community Theater. I don't remember the name of
it. But it was the movie theater or the
Community Players who are in a church?
Yeah, and they now have a new theater.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, we were just up there a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, and it's been a couple years since I've been up there.
And we didn't actually see it, but they were just having their premiere in the new building.
Okay, good for them. Good for them.
I couldn't help wondering how Robbie combined his high level of furniture making with theater. It seemed like a pretty unlikely combination. So I asked him.
You know, I spent 10 years at Living History Farms as their furniture maker there. And those years I was at Living History Farms, I did shows at the Ingersoll and Des Moines Playhouse and Stage West. And I just really tried to pay attention with every director that I worked with and how, you know, his philosophies and how they direct. And I took lessons for a couple of years under James Serpento. There in Des Moines.
I've been to show with Jim.
And excellent. And Kim Busby, you know, excellent acting teachers. And they teach both acting for film and stage. Two very completely different animals. And I got to be in a couple of their films. And that was a lot of fun.
So basically this was intense education in the theater rather than in a university program. Did you study in university before?
I had no idea I liked musical theater when I was in college. I wish I would have. I just didn't have any idea I liked it. I sang in rock bands in college, and after college, I was taking lessons from the Drake opera coach, and he talked me into auditioning for a musical that he was directing, and I just got hooked on it. And my first role was at the Ingersoll, and there was 38 nights of that first show. And that's the way you get stage time, stage experience. Do a show 38 times, and you get pretty comfortable up there. And I ended up doing over 20 shows there at the Ingersoll, you know, 300-400 nights on stage.
Well, no wonder you have been able to put together this incredible place. You do some very unique things with your theater. I believe this upcoming show, Murder Ballad, is some kind of a premiere. How does that work?
Well, it's a 4-person cast, the show is. And it's with a 3-person band. We've got a 3-person rock combo that's going to be playing for it. And it takes place in a New York bar. And it's about a love triangle that kind of goes wrong, you know. And every line in that show is sung. There are no spoken lines in that. It's like a rap opera, but in musical form. It's got a true story with it, and actions, and dance, and the works.
Seems to me I read that this is the first time it's been in Iowa or where. What's the first on this?
This one is a Midwest premiere, so it hasn't been ran in Chicago, Minneapolis, or Kansas City, or Omaha yet. But you can see it in Jefferson, Iowa. And we kind of pride ourselves in those kinds of things. We do a lot of premieres like that. I think just two theaters in the country have beaten us to the national premiere. The one we did this summer, the Bluegrass musical that we did in June, was a national premiere. And so that was neat because we got to meet the writer and everything with that. And when you're in a small town in Iowa, that's a very cool thing to get to meet the writer and to put on his show.
So where did it go after it left here?
Well, you know, we put it on with our own cast, so it didn't leave here. It just, the rights, you know, went out, and he let other theaters do it, too. About 4 years ago, there was a big deal show in New York called Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, and we were the national premiere to that. It ran on Broadway for 9 months, and we got it first. We got it before anybody else, and since then, in the last 4 years, over 300 theater companies in the country have done it.
No wonder you won an award. Could you tell us about that award you won?
The combination of the Furniture Shop and Museum and our theater were named the Tourism Business of the Year in Iowa last year. And yet we do still feel like we're very much a secret. We're happy. Anybody can come our direction. We do hear from almost everybody that comes in here. Once you're here, you know, you're a fan. You're going to come back. And for the wives out there that have trouble getting their husbands to theater, we are known as husband winners. With the shows that we pick and the type of theater we're in, people are welcome to bring beer and wine to our theater. And, you know, sit and enjoy yourself in a very comfortable setting and see very different, interesting shows. This is the place to come.
And the husband who really got dragged here can peruse your woodwork business and look at all the stuff and pretty feel he's gone to a masculine place.
There you go. There you go.
Well, your coming show is going to premiere on New Year's Eve. So why don't we get the times on that and talk about its future showings?
So you have your New Year's show coming up. And you have not only New Year's Eve performance, but you're also doing other performance dates.
Yes, this year, Wednesday, January 31st at 6 o'clock will be the dinner and a show. Then the 2nd and the 3rd, Friday and Saturday night, we'll also do those as well. Not very public yet. I suppose I'm making it public. If those sell out good enough, we will add on a second weekend without a dinner. And we're also exploring maybe taking it to another town. We do that with shows. Like our last show we took to the Greenfield Opera House, just for something different. And we always gain fans when we go to other towns and kind of win their favor there. But this is such an interesting show in that it's a rock musical, and it takes place in a New York bar. So it's not for I'd hate to show up at a city auditorium or a school and put it on a stage. That would just not feel right. It's got to be in a right setting. And so we'll either do it here or we'll find some cool bar setting or something and pretend like we're the house band for a night.
Well, he talked quite a bit about how they were going to stage it. And we don't have that on our recording. But would you like to talk about that a little bit, Paul?
Well, he's going to, the seating is the usual presidium seating in front of a stage. But he's going to have tables and people up on the stage also. So they're going to do this performance between the presidium seating and the stage and the people. It's actually theater in the round. And so when you do theater in the round, you have to remember that you have to perform to everybody around you. It's totally different than classic theater where you're had the fourth wall, you know. So this is kind of a unique way to put on a show. And Robbie, what I really like about Robbie is he takes chances. He'll try things. Look at his propensity to premiere new works and things that haven't been done before. And he's finding new ways. He's just an immensely creative person, not only with this furniture business and all the things he does there. And look at the thorough research he's done on the 1800s and all the techniques and everything. Everything about him is just so complete, and he's so detail-oriented. But when you look around this vast area, everything is a work in progress. You can see he just putters and putters and gets things done. But this is going to be a unique show. And for people who want something different on New Year's Eve, this is where you want to go.
And one of the other things that he has a different concept of is dinner theater. He says this is not dinner theater. This is a show with a dinner. And he's catered this with Perry, the Hotel Petit, which, as most people in this area know, is an award-winning hotel and a dinner place. And the places where you eat the dinner are not the places where you watch the show from. So you can be up on the mezzanine and have your dinner, and maybe some of those will have some seats that you can pull over. But mostly you go down and sit in these comfortable seats he's been talking about.
Right. You get up from your dinner, you sit in a regular theater seat. And in a dinner theater, we've all been there, and when the show starts, you have to turn your chair around or get adjusted, and it's not nearly as comfortable as a theatrical seat. So everyone eats, then they move to the presidium theater seating and enjoy the show. And in this case, it'll be done in the round.
And another thing that he mentioned is that people can bring their own beverages. They can bring beer and wine, and that's just a little thing that people should know. It's whatever you want to do. It sounds like just a tremendously relaxed and fun evening. And he did mention that they would be almost surely doing a second weekend.
Yeah, he says it's always sold out. And when you do things like Robbie does up there, you get tremendous word of mouth, and you get all kinds of folks who pass it on, and then you develop almost, and I think in Robbie's case, you'd call it a cult following, you know, people who are devoted to coming up to those shows. And the same is probably true for his clientele in his furniture business, too. That's word of mouth, and he's the ultimate entrepreneur, let's put it that way.
Right. But once you've seen it, you're pretty close to hooked, I think. And incidentally, he was pretty close to being sold out for that first weekend already when we were there. Somebody came in to buy tickets, and it was pretty clear there were not very many left.
And then he mentioned that, you know, people procrastinate. So this is very early in the game, and he'll be having all kinds of rush as they approach the holidays. So I'm sure he'll be sold out and probably have to schedule even more performances. Great opportunity.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Paul Wearson and I have been on a road trip to Jefferson to RVP 1875, Robbie Peterson's furniture studio, workshop, and home of the History Boy Theater. And later on, we'll be passing by and mentioning some Christmas tree farms. But before we leave Jefferson, I think a little bit more conversation about that very amazing place is in store.
Well, I just was so impressed with everything we saw there. It was just a revelation. I would think it would be wonderful just to take maybe a class from school over there just to look at that place and see what not only the furniture businesses and all the things Robbie has to say about what was happening in the 19th century. But also, they could go in and look at the theater and just see this amazing, amazing place. And I forgot to ask him if he had any road trips or things where school kids came in to see this, because really, it would be fascinating if you were a government or social studies teacher talking about the Civil War era or the 19th century. To come in and see all the things that, once you walk in there, it's the 19th century. Think how fascinating and tactile that would be for students, like in a middle school class. How amazing it would be just to see and touch and feel all the stuff that Robbie has in there. And also they'd be fascinated by what we were fascinated by, those wonderful machines that he has, you know, all the stuff that was powered by people power back in the 1800s, and the kids would be fascinated. Looks like the best, well, it'd be a good road trip if you're 10 years old. For us who are older than 10, I won't say how much older.
Well, we don't remember 1875.
No, at least I was in middle school at the time, but I didn't even pay attention to the world. But Robbie is, you can just tell by the enthusiasm in his voice how totally involved he is. We all probably envy somebody who can be so totally wrapped up in their vocation. It's not just their vocation and their source of income, but their a labor of love. You know, he is totally committed to this. And his wife, I wish we'd had a chance to talk with her, too. She is his co-partner in every way. And I think it just, he's the kind of guy that when he gets up in the morning and goes to bed at night, in the time in between, he's done what all of us dream of doing, the things he loves to do.
That's right. And incidentally about Angie, she is also the co-director of this show. And when they did this bluegrass musical, it was a two-person show and she was the other person. So they had a pretty intense summer.
And they also toured doing Oklahoma. And Robbie, they did a two-person show there. And they sang all the songs from Oklahoma. It's a condensed form of Oklahoma down to 45 minutes. So you have a three-hour stage show that Robbie condensed into a 45-minute show, mostly songs and patter that go with the show. So he's a very creative guy, and so is she. And I think that probably the sky's the limit. Who knows what will happen there in Jefferson? It's really unique. And as you said, as he mentioned in our interview, he got the top prize in the state of Iowa for the tourist attraction, and just very evident why.
Well, when I saw the prize, I thought, did he get it or did Jefferson? And it's very clear that Jefferson is really a moving place. I didn't get the population of Jefferson. Do you happen to know?
I don't know. It would probably be over 5,000, certainly, mm-hmm. as a county seat. And Jefferson is a very, very forward-looking community. They have the annual Bell Tower Festival in Jefferson. You know, every town seems to have a festival. That's a pretty good-sized one. And I think that they've really been very helpful with Robbie. You see, Robbie comes from Jefferson, and at Story City, where he had his store prior to this, where I live in Story City, it just became too large for that, and the building was going to be sold. There were all kinds of things going on, and Robbie did a nationwide search for a place to locate his business, and lo and behold, he ended up in his hometown, and they made that very, very receptive for him by, you know, financial arrangements, and also it enabled him to have this great space, the former lumber yard in Jefferson. That's why we have this cavernous theater and such a great building for his purposes. So it's ironic, you know, life is a circle. You come back to your hometown where you least expected to be, and that's where you bloom and flourish, and that's kind of poetic, too, about Robbie's situation. Yeah.
Well, incidentally, our engineer, who has access to other resources of information, tells me that the population of Jefferson is 4,237.
Very good. Thanks, Becca. She is great. Man, a research person.
And that may explain why when we were driving around the city square where they have this very large county courthouse, that you noticed the Jefferson statue in the front of the courthouse of Thomas Jefferson. And all I was doing was looking for the restaurant that we were going to eat lunch at. And there were four restaurants on the city square. And I think plus the uptown, which was just about half a block off the city square where we finally did have lunch.
Yeah, we got lost on the city square. We went around and around and finally found the Uptown Cafe. And, you know, I did notice that the business district in Jefferson, very healthy, hardly any vacant spaces, and clean. Everything is happening. A lot of cars parked downtown on a weekday. You can tell that commerce is occurring there and that that's a healthy community. So, you know, we talk about these county seats and towns that have they probably stayed about the same population but they haven't lost anything, you see. And Jefferson's a good example of a town that's holding its own, and it's also being very inventive about its future, and it's obviously very friendly to entrepreneurs and business. So you can tell when a community is being governed properly, where the right choices are made about industry coming in and people you're encouraging to be entrepreneurs and business people. And to your open eyes when you walk into town, you can tell that Jefferson is what I would call a happening place. You know,
Jefferson in Greene County. Jefferson County is someplace else.
Yeah.
And but Greene County is where we may get to make other road trips. Incidentally, one of the places in Jefferson that we were going to visit yesterday, but we ran out of time, was Deal's Orchard and Christmas Tree Farm. And I was particularly interested in it being a Christmas tree farm because Deal's Orchard sells their cider and their apples here in Ames. And so I'm very familiar with Deal's Orchard. We also buy from Storybook Orchard, which is over at Story City.
Right. I know that family.
Uh-huh.
They are very enterprising. It's just like a pioneer family on farm-to-market days, you know, all over the central Iowa area. The whole family gets up, and they're up at dawn, and they're shipping down to wherever the farmer's market is. And they are wonderful people. They just that's their enterprise, their life. And so I'm sure that's indicative of that industry. And the place you're describing, probably the family is involved at the same level. It's fun to watch.
All right. And it's probably the combination of an orchard and a Christmas tree farm may be happening in other places. I don't know very many. And there may be other smaller Christmas tree farms. These are all members of the Iowa Christmas Tree Growers Association that we'll be mentioning. So I didn't mean to slight anybody, but these are the ones that identify themselves as Christmas tree farms. And Deal's Orchard has, in addition to the Christmas trees, it also has 28 varieties of gift baskets, and it has a showroom that's a gift shop where you can go in and have coffee and cookies and cider, and there's a Santa sleigh you can have your picture taken in, and jams and jellies, I think. And this is the winter business. There's their summer business and fall business is their apples, and that's another possible destination.
Well, I think that a lot of these Christmas tree growers are too kinds of facilities where you can just go in and get your tree, and there's sort of a business, you know, that they're running. And then there's the folks who run these enterprises who also create an event for you. There are things for the kids to do, Santa visits. There are all kinds of things you can buy, arts and crafts and things, and always hot chocolate and things that really call up the Christmas season in the minds of young and old.
Well, on the way home, we're going to pass another turnoff for a Christmas tree farm that I visited earlier in connection with another road trip. This was the road trip about Kate Shelley. And the land that Kate Shelley lived on, the Shelley land, you could hardly call it a farm. It's because it's really hilly. But this land is now the Enchanted Valley Tree Farm. And Joe Reuter, who's the owner of this, gave us a tour and kept mentioning what they did when it was time for the Christmas trees. Mostly, you never get to see this land unless you go and buy a Christmas tree or look for a Christmas tree. So this is the time to see the Kate Shelley land. And it's quite hilly, so they have transportation. I think it's a very large golf cart that will take you up to where the trees are. And they bring them down, and there's a fire. I don't think they don't have a gift shop. It's all outdoors, but I think they have plenty to keep you warm and active. And it would be, I think, a very interesting trip. And it's just on the east side of the Des Moines River. Moingona, where Kate Shelley crawled on that night, is on the west side, and her farm was on the east side. And so it's a pretty interesting Christmas tree road trip.
Yes, very good. And you have several farms listed here. That are Christmas tree sources for everybody who wants to cut their own and have their own tree. And you've been to all these places, Susan?
Oh, no. I just happened to be at Joe Reuter's and thought, oh, we need to do that. We need to mention that when you can really go there and let people know that. Because part of the point of our road trips is to make people aware of places they'd enjoy going. We couldn't do justice to what we saw in Jefferson, but that's usually the case. We can talk about it, but it's a different experience when you go there.
Well, yeah, hopefully if people are listening to the program, they can, by our visit and by our exploration of these things, check them out themselves. And I think the real revelation in doing these road trips is how rich our environment is in terms of things to do, places to go, things of interest that most people don't know about that are right there if you just look for them. And I just love doing these road trips where it's a discovery for me, too, to find these places, talk to the people involved. And what really is fascinating is that, just like with Robbie Peterson, most of these people, and you'd see that at the tree farms, too, it's a labor of love. And you ask a guy who's running a couple who's running one of these Christmas tree farms, and I'm sure they'll tell you that the payoff for them is the delight in a child's face and the fun a family has going out and getting their tree. And maybe they're arguing about which one to have. But you know that everybody out there that day is building a memory that they'll be talking about 70 years from now. That's quite a vocation.
That's quite a vocation. And, of course, the Christmas tree farm is a 12-month operation. And so, for example, I did mention Joe Reuter because he's the one we've seen. He's been interviewed a couple times in connection with Kate Shelley, but it's Joe and Janice Reuter. And they run the farm together. And I presume that means plant the trees, take care of the trees.
Well, you've got to not only shape them and prune them, but also you have to worry about the things all farmers worry about, disease and troubles, drought. You know, a lot of Christmas trees went down in the drought in certain parts of the country, too. So, and it's a 7-year cycle. What happens now, if there's a drought and a lot of trees don't mature, that doesn't impact the market till 7 years from now.
Really?
Yes, that's the time lag for growing Christmas trees.
Well, one of the things that you always emphasize is how much we learn every time we go out.
The beauty of Iowa are all these county seats with the beautiful ornate courthouses right in the city square. That everything is built around that. And you can just see how we grew out of the 19th century and the time that Iowa was settled and how these communities were designed. Made great sense then, and they're beautiful now.
That's right. And incidentally, the population of Greene County is 9,000.
So most of it is Jefferson. It's also the home of Hugh Seide, the Washington correspondent for Time magazine. And I spent some time there last year. I narrated a film about the Seide family. And so that's also another thing about the city that's important. Home of Hugh Seide.
As well as George Gallup, who's was very instrumental in early polling 50 years ago, back when Fritz's father used to work with him. And the thing about – the reason I mentioned him and the reason I discovered that is that his family home, which was an octagonal house, is now a bed and breakfast. And so when you go to the History Boy Theater, you might look up and see if it's possible to stay at the Gallup House, which is – very interesting-looking house.
Oh, Iowa has all kinds of places like this because the bed and breakfast industry is its own. There are beautiful places also along the Mississippi, these big mansions overlooking the Mississippi River. Several of them have been transformed into bed and breakfast. So Iowa is just replete with bed and breakfast enterprises, and that, too, is a labor of love. It's usually a husband and wife who've made a big commitment to have your business where you live and spend thousands of dollars restoring, let's say, a Victorian mansion into a bed and breakfast. So Iowa has all kinds of things like that. You just have to be able to, and nowadays on the internet, it's easy to find these places compared to what it used to be. But we're instrumental, I hope, in doing this show, in actually visiting places and tipping people off to what tremendous things we have right within our broadcast area here in central Iowa.
And speaking within our broadcast area, we have some more Christmas tree farms to mention. In Maxwell, we have the Christmas tree farm with Sandra Hunter. And in Story County, we have the Stroutman tree farm near Cambridge. And up in Hamilton County, we have Riverside Trees with Jerry and Kelly Van Vector, and that's Duncombe in Duncombe, Iowa. And there are probably others that we haven't discovered. So look around your area if you want a live tree and the experience of cutting it down yourself.
Yes, the live tree, we used to have one on the farm, and that was always quite an enterprise to get that in there and placed and watered. And of course, as time went on, the needles started to fall out and all. But you know, you can't duplicate that aroma of the tree in the house.
No, you can't duplicate the experience of trying to fit the tree into your Christmas tree holder either.
No, that might have strained many marriages.
Well, I will not tell what our solution was to that problem because we are running out of time, and I think it's time for us to bid you adieu from Local Talk on Community Radio. Today we have been talking with Robbie Peterson, talking about a lot of other people who weren't on the air with us. Local Talk is engineered by Rebecca Brown. Music you heard included Oh Christmas Tree by Thematic Pianos from the CD Children's Christmas Songs, as well as Willie Nelson On the Road Again.
And our theme song, Backtracking, by Al Harris and Tom Richards from the CD The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Now, you know, you can listen to this show and all of our local talk shows in the past online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, where you'll find an archive for all the local talk shows we've produced since we went on the air back in 2012. We are now streaming live as well. Recent shows have been posted on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, can get the information. There you will find lists of our guests and links to the organizations and other resources mentioned in our shows over time.
KHOI thanks those of you who have become members of KHOI. If you have not joined yet, please consider doing so by the end of the year. KHOI is looking to raise $40,000 by the end of January, so this is a great time for you to join in. Basic memberships are $40, premium memberships are $100, and we are looking as well for those of you who can become sustaining members with a donation of $250 or more. But of course, we are appreciative of any donation you can make. Please donate online to KHOI at khoifm.org or just come by the KHOI studio at 410 Douglas in Ames or send it in the mail. You can find our address at khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. Now, if you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878 or at the email address of khoiradio@gmail.com. Your participation as audience makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening and see you
again
on
the radio.